Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll deal with a number of stories in the news. We'll begin in a moment with a very important story that has just broken this last week, and that is an admission from the person who was largely responsible for providing the so-called evidence that the U.S. used to go to war against Iraq, the so-called curveball. We'll be talking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's chief of staff, who believes now the evidence is clear that the United States was manipulated into making, and of course Colin Powell was manipulated into making a case for war. And we'll be talking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson in a moment about who he feels is responsible and what should be done about this, given the amount of treasure and the loss of lives that have followed this war based upon the lies of this dissembler curveball. And then we will talk with Will Bunch, who is an award-winning senior writer with Philadelphia Daily News. He has a brand new book, The Backlash: Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. And this book is an absolutely important and invaluable adjunct to what is happening now in Wisconsin, where we have serious protests numbering 70,000 people in the streets and counter-protests from the Tea Party. So we'll be talking about the agenda of the Tea Party and try and examine those behind the Tea Party who might well be profiting from the activities of the Tea Party. And then finally, in the second hour, we'll be joined by Joseph Nye, who's a Harvard University Distinguished Service Professor and former Dean of the Kennedy School of Government. He has a new book just published, The Future of Power. And he, of course, is somebody that in the past has written about soft power. And now he's talking about how the internet, Egyptian uprising, was talking about how the internet has empowered ordinary citizens with the tools that governments have usually reserved to themselves. And he's now talking about a new theory of geopolitics called smart power. So we'll be talking to him in the second hour. I'm joined by Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff at the Department of State from August 2002 to January 2005. He began working with Powell as his Deputy Executive Officer starting in 1989 until Powell's retirement from active service in 1993. Colonel Wilkerson served as the Deputy Director and Director of the United States Marine Corps War College at Quantico, Virginia. And Wilkerson also rejoined Powell's staff as a civilian in the State Department. And in October of 2005, Colonel Wilkerson, after considerable soul-searching, went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. He currently teaches courses at the College of William and Mary and at George Washington University. Thank you so much for joining us on Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Nice to be with you, Ian.
And the Guardian in England has been uncovering some evidence that has sort of been there, but it's never been quite so blatant and inescapable, and that is the extent to which curveball, the dissembler whose information was used in part in the case that Colin Powell made before the United Nations, and you, of course, were there as his deputy throughout that period. Do you feel now that this is a game changer, even though previously, you know, I've spoken with Tyler Drumheller in the past, the CIA officer in charge of Europe in the CIA at the time, who did go to the head of the CIA, George Tenet, at the time, and said, this information is not good, but nothing was done. So that's the area that I've always wondered about, and I'm sure you've wondered about.
Well, of course I have. As I've done research since I left the State Department, and things have been open to me, and people have come to talk to me on background mostly, I've come to understand just how much it was not totally an intelligence failure. It was that, as most of the CIA and INR and DIA and other intelligence community people want to claim that it was, who were professionals. But it was also, and a lot of them don't want to admit to it because they don't want to admit to folding to this kind of pressure. It was enormous political pressure brought upon the intelligence community, and particularly upon the head of it, the DCI, George Tenet, and his deputy, John McLaughlin, to, as the British put it, shape the intelligence around the policy. And when my book comes out, I'm going to try to prove that with a certitude, a level of certitude that simply hasn't existed before. But I'll be very frank and add, I don't think it'll make a damn bit of difference.
Well, the tragedy's already befallen us. We've lost trillions of in treasure and thousands in lives. Our reputation has been damaged. It's very clear that the only winners in Iraq have been the Iranians, and they're proving to be a very pernicious regime.
That's true. I would, however, like to see, as I would in any occasion of massive failure like this, particularly when it includes complicity and even lying from the highest levels in the land, some kind of accountability. And I see no moral courage. I see no political courage. I see no political will. I see no one other than perhaps people like you and I and a few others scattered across the country who really wants to achieve that kind of accountability. And I simply don't believe that you can go on with your record marred in such an indubitable and serious way and not make any attempt to correct it or to hold those who marred it accountable in some fashion, and expect to be the same democratic republic that you were before. And every little marginal or substantive increment we make on that democratic republic in terms of turning it into a tyranny is another step towards that tyranny. And I could write a book right now. I could map out a road to tyranny in this country that would take place in the next generation. And that's scary. I don't like it. I don't like it for my grandchildren. I don't like it for my children. I don't like it for myself. Indeed, if I've got 10 or 15 years left, I could live to see this.
Well, Colonel Wilkerson, again, Colin Powell is a former chief of staff who was at the highest levels of decision making during the first 4 years of the Bush administration and during the build up to the Iraq war. It is extraordinary that there isn't more moral outrage amongst the public. But I think to some extent one has to hold the media responsible for not focusing on these vital important issues, given the consequences of these actions that we are still paying for and will continue to pay for, not the least of which is torture, which has enabled every dictator in the world to get away with torture, as Mubarak's thugs were recently doing, on the basis, well, the Americans do it. So the damage has been absolutely devastating, but the other side, the people most responsible for these catastrophes, seem to be on the public relations offensive. I saw Donald Rumsfeld interviewed recently by Diane Sawyer, where he was absolutely brazen in his disdain of your former boss, Colin Powell. Also, he was disdainful of Condoleezza Rice, suggesting, oh, she was useless. She was an academic. They like to take meetings. So I think I don't blame you for wanting to be on the offensive here, because the bad guys, if you will, are on the offensive.
I don't think they're making a whole lot of headway, though, except with their own crowd. And I'll hasten to add that I think their crowd scares me to death. I think their crowd, a hallmark of that kind of tyranny I was talking about, not a king, not a military takeover, but the kind of tyranny that we've seen, for example, from Wall Street, and indeed still see from Wall Street, as the big banks continue to suck billions of taxpayer dollars down their throats and don't do anything for the American economy. That's tyranny. That's insidious tyranny. That's the kind of tyranny I'm talking about. I had a conversation with a couple of folks last night who are in a position to know. They had just screened the documents that Donald Rumsfeld put on his website. Well, Donald did his usual there. He didn't do due diligence. Brazen attempt to infiltrate, if you will, dump on the web all these documents. Many of the documents that are in that site actually are antithetical to, directly contradict things he says in his book. So this is Donald. Donald is a quintessential liar. Bill Seidman, who was head of the RTC for Ronald Reagan, head of the FDC for a long time, God bless his soul, before he died, told me in 2001 at a lunch, "Watch out for Rumsfeld. He is the best liar I've ever seen in my life." And Seidman saw Rumsfeld up close and personal during the Ford administration, where he and Cheney sort of broke into the executive branch positions. That's what Rumsfeld is. He's a quintessential liar. I'm reminded of that line from Witness for the Prosecution, you know, that Charles Laughton delivers so powerfully, a chronic and habitual liar. That's Rumsfeld.
Well, I suppose there was some justice done at the recent CPAC meeting where former Vice President Cheney presented Rumsfeld with, believe it or not, the Defender of the Constitution Award, and apparently a lot of the Tea Party supporters of Ron Paul and others booed and heckled him rather mercilessly throughout the his talk. But you're arguing, as a result of these findings, these statements by Curveball, and the extent to which that was used as evidence to go to war, which was presented by Colin Powell to the United Nations, you're saying that you think that Vice President, it was the Vice President's office that manipulated you and Secretary of State Powell into giving the speech.
No question in my mind. First of all, Cheney was the one that decided that Powell would do it. After all, he had the poll ratings of a Mother Teresa. He was the only one in the administration in the low 70s. Everyone else was in the 50s or below. I think Cheney at the time was in the 40s or below. The only person who could deliver it and have the American people believe it, and indeed the international community perhaps changed some of its minds, particularly in France and places like that, was Colin Powell. So he picked Colin Powell to do it. Second, I now know that the people who were surveilling me, as it were, when I was out at Langley for 5 days and five nights and then in New York, that two of those people at least were telephoning the vice president's office as often as they were talking to their boss, George Tenet. I also know that the evidence that was planted in the NIE in October 2002, that was planted with the complicity of the DCI and the DDCI, some objections within INR at State, DOE, Department of Energy, and others, but nonetheless was planted and became the October 2002 NIE on Iraq, was crafted in Douglas Feist's Office of Special Plans in the Pentagon, passed through the vice president for his ultimate imprimatur, and then visited on the CIA through WinPAC and these people in WinPAC. So I know how it happened. I know how the intelligence became politicized. I know it emanated in the vice president's office, that the orchestration of it was in Feist's office under Rumsfeld, and that the vice president's unprecedented 11 trips by the vice president of the United States to the CIA. I dare say if you check the historical record, you won't find half a dozen trips to the CIA in the post-World War II era by a single vice president or by all of them combined. So he brought just enormous pressure to bear on the intelligence community in addition to having his spies. So it was politicized. Is this the first time this has ever happened? No, it's happened before. But this is the first time the Vice President of the United States has brought the White House so directly into this kind of process. And it's the first time I've ever been involved in it. So it's professional and personal failure on my part that I feel great angst for having participated in.
But Colonel Wilkerson, again, Colin Powell's former chief of staff. If you were to shape this in Shakespearean terms, in this situation, Dick Cheney is, he's Richard III, you name it. But
I'd say Iago.
Iago, exactly. but if that's the case, then George Tenet is the Brutus, right?
I can't. Ian, I've wrestled with this. I read his book. I know there are blatant lies in his book. I was there. I was the only person there 24/7. I slept about 2-3 hours in the course of the whole time I was out at Langley. I was listening at keyholes, as it were. My boss took me in rooms, closed the door, and hammered me for what he thought was insubstantial evidence and intelligence and so forth. I went through the whole process. I'm the only person who went through the whole process. I can say George Tenet and John McLaughlin lied.
And the extent to which the vice president was orchestrating these lies, his office also were responsible for pushing the other part of the disinformation to go to war in Iraq, and that was the Niger forgeries. As you know, they were the basis of why Ambassador Wilson was sent, and that kind of blew up in the White House's face because it was mentioned in State of the Union, and then Ambassador Wilson went public, and then in retaliation against him, Cheney's office through Scooter Libby leaked the existence of his wife in the CIA and outed Valerie Plame. But nobody's ever really gotten to the heart of who forged those the Niger forgeries. At least nobody's ever gone public with them. I believe that Senator Rockefeller and his committee had some evidence, and that evidence was pointing towards the vice president's office. But for reasons I don't understand, they backed off.
Well, my evidence points towards lackeys of the vice president's office, either willing lackeys or directed lackeys. I can't say yet. I hope I can find the smoking gun that tells me that there was some direction from there, but these are the same kinds of things that happened around Watergate and happened around the Iran-Contra affair, for example, where a president or vice president says, not me, because some willing lackey went out and did his deeds for him. But one of the things that stands out clear to me is this. You either have to come down on the side of the argument that says these were the dumbest people ever occupying their positions, or you have to come down on the side that they were complicit with, integral to, and illustrative of even a set of lies. I cannot imagine having worked with these people, Scooter Libby, Cheney when he was Secretary of Defense, George Tenet, John McLaughlin. I've known John McLaughlin for some time, a true intelligence professional, not a political hack like Tenet. I can't imagine that I could call them incompetent, grossly so, stupid, even ignorant, and even begin to believe it. So I've got to believe the other side of the argument.
And that's not to say, though, that their actions have been catastrophic, and arguably they have been the wrecking crew of foreign policy.
That's a point. I know what Bob Drogan, for example, said in his book Curveball, what others have said. That's nice for media drama. That's nice for headlines and so forth. But I know this, too. Had Curveball not existed, had Powell never gone to the UN, George W. Bush and Richard Bruce Cheney would have invaded Iraq anyway.
Well, I'm sure they would, and I think that's the reckoning that we need. I feel in many ways that Bush is still a kind of zombie president. He has booby-trapped the economy to the point where we're paralyzed, and Obama may not be reelected because of the legacy of Wall Street. He has booby-trapped our foreign policy. We are sitting on the sidelines while history is being made in the Middle East, because where all of our assets are in Afghanistan, all of our Arabic speakers, etc. We didn't even know what was going on in Cairo because everybody's in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I watched Nader Hashimi, assistant professor of Islamic and Middle East political studies at the University of Denver last night on The Real News, and I one of his lines just reverberates in my mind. We were watching scenes of Algeria, scenes of Bahrain, scenes of Cairo, scenes of the streets in Sana'a in Yemen, and he said U.S. policy is unraveling. It is.
And while this is happening, the U.S. is vetoing U.N. resolutions at Israel's behest. At the very moment that it supposedly, one would think, would want to show some solidarity with the Arab street.
I have no confidence any longer in the political courage of anyone in the White House. That act, if any single act destroyed my confidence in anyone's having any political courage, that was certainly it. I mean, you're right. It was the most opportunistic time, the greatest opportunity in a long time to reset the entire process, the way the United States confronts the Israeli-Palestinian-Arab problem. And we did nothing. We just went right along as if nothing had changed. It's as if we can't even smell or see what's happening in the streets in Western Asia and in the Middle East, or for that matter in Islamabad or in Kabul or any other Baghdad, of a number of places that are just reeking with change, and we sit there like the typical imperial power, acting as if nothing is happening when the sands are sifting out of the very foundation of our base.
Sort of reminds me of the Shelley poem, right? Ozymandias, King of Kings,
yes.
Look upon me, you mighty in despair.
And well, it is one of the characteristics of empires in precipitous decline that their rhetoric is directly the opposite. Their rhetoric is of being the indispensable power, of being an exceptional nation, of being inexhaustible and forever, and so forth and so on. That's the way they talk at the end.
Well, it's my only excuse, if it's and certainly not one doesn't need to make excuses for the president, is that he's obviously looking over his shoulder at the domestic political landscape for re-election in 2012, and he simply doesn't want to take on AIPAC.
I understand that, and I think he's going to be reelected now, and I think he's going to be reelected principally because my party can't even find a candidate to run against him. But I think we are on a road that has a very disastrous end already in sight for us. We've restored, through Geithner and Summers and other people who've had influence on his economic policy, we've restored the status quo ante with a little bit of regulation here and there. We've given the banks, the big banks, control again. And anyone who thinks that those banks are going to use that control for anything other than more self-remuneration, more huge profits, and not for the betterment of the American economy, I think is smoking something. We're just put our train, our economic and financial train, back on the same track. And the same big, dark wall is up there ahead for that train to crash into.
But your party, Colonel Wilkerson, the Republican Party, appears to have been captured by the know-nothings. I mean, there was
I think both parties are a disaster. The Republicans are, yes, I give you that the Republicans are a bigger disaster than the Democrats, especially vis-a-vis our infrastructure, the need to improve it, the need to rehabilitate it, the financial situation in general. Regulation, you name it. My party is on so many bad points that I don't even know where to start anymore. But the Democrats are complicit enough through either the fact that they just simply don't know how to fight, or because, and this is the case with some of them, they too are heavily invested in this system we've created, which pays the rich and robs the poor, that they won't do anything about it. The maldistribution of wealthiness, I was looking at the figures last night. 87% of America in 2010, 87% owned 13% of the wealth.
Well, we're going to be talking about what's going on in Wisconsin and with somebody who's written about the Tea Party. But my final question to you, Colonel Wilkerson, would be, you know, what happened to the Eisenhower Republicans? I mean, if you've got 50% of the Republican rank and file obsessed with Obama and not being a U.S. citizen and being a Muslim, the level of anti-intellectualism is scary, and the extent to which it seems the Tea Party seems to serve the interests of the very plutocrats and monopolies that you're railing against. For example, the Koch brothers, they're funding these people.
I don't disagree with you. I don't see a progressive element out there, and that's what I would call it, a progressive element, after, for example, Teddy Roosevelt's moves. I just don't see it out there anymore. I don't know what to call them, but they certainly aren't the kinds of people who brought us labor unions, for example, who brought us the Civil Rights Act, who brought us the kind of civil liberties in general that we enjoy today. There aren't that people around anymore. Instead, we have people who are so fearful of a handful of terrorists, for example, that they'll give up 20-25% of their civil liberties. They're so fearful of those terrorists that they'll let the Republicans run rampant with the Patriot Act. They're so fearful of their own situation in this world that they will allow the tyranny that we fought against 250 years ago and now are courting the very presence of again in the form of leaders who don't have any options, who don't have any purpose other than the enrichment of their clique, of their clan. I don't know what you do. if Wisconsin, for example, right now, is an indication of what you do, and it spreads across the country, then I will come on your show tomorrow morning and say, mea culpa, I changed my mind. The American people know what's going on, and they are taking action, just like the Egyptians, just like others in the world who want more freedom and liberty or want to restore it. Americans have woken up, and they're doing something. But until that happens, it's not going to come from the top. The top has proven itself incompetent, cowardly even, and certainly not capable of seeing a new light at the end of the tunnel and fashioning a strategy to get it. It's got to come from the grassroots level. If Wisconsin spreads, I'll be the first person out there cheering for its spread.
Well, Colonel Wilkerson, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff at the Department of State from August 2002 to January 2005. He began working with Colonel Powell as his Deputy Executive Officer starting in 1989 until Powell's retirement from active service in 1993. Colonel Wilkerson served as the Deputy Director and Director of the United States Marine Corps War College at Quantico, Virginia. He joined Colin Powell's staff as a civilian in the State Department in October 2005, Colonel Wilkerson, after considerable soul-searching, went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. He currently teaches courses at the College of William and Mary and at George Washington University.